Mr. Chadwick, Rail 3, we're talking about your training, perhaps a typical day, while you're with Salamanca squad at Bransworth Castle. And we were looking at rifle training and how you were trained. Did they teach you how to maintain your rifle, how to clean it and look after it?
Oh, yes. Weapon maintenance. You were taught the three basic weapons were rifle, LMG, and the 36 grenade. Throwing off. And of course, then days, I'm sure you've heard of the other, an EY rifle, an extra yielding rifle that fired a grenade with a discharger cup, which was never successful. It was a reinforced reentry with a discharger cup on the top, and it was never a success. If you couldn't, if you're throwing a grenade, you can throw it far enough for what it's supposed to do. Firing it up in the air, out of a rifle, didn't do the job it was made for, in my book.
Did you actually get to fire the EY rifle?
Oh, yes. Everybody fired it once. Oh, and the Piat, the primary infantry anti-tank weapon.
Now, I'm going to run through this. Just for the maintenance of your rifle, how did they teach you to clean? I mean, were they fussy about the state of your rifle?
Very fussy, especially on guard mounting. But you see, you had to keep it maintained because whenever you used it, it was inspected afterwards. And if it wasn't clean, you were put on a charge.
How did they teach you to clean it?
Well, regulation flannelette with a pull through, what they call 4x2. Well, 4x2 is the measurement of cloth you put on your pull-through. That's why it's called 4x2. But its name is regulation flannelette. As a matter of fact, I used to wrap boxing ring ropes with it to stop you getting rope burns when you were boxing. The cleanup of a rifle is simple. You've got an oil bottle, a pull-through, and regulation flannelette in the butt of the rifle. And all that you do is remove the bolt with an old toothbrush, clean all the particles, dust and dirt, and literally pull the weapon through 3 or 4 times to clear all the knurling of the barrel. Then look through it, and you can see the glistening and the rifling, as it's called, the knurling, all the way down. They often used to say, there's a bird's nest in this rifle, or whatever. Put your thumb in the breech and look down the muzzle. Well, you can't do that. But the officer would tell you, when he said board inspection 4 times, you'd pull the bolt back, put your thumb in, and he'd look down the barrel. And he would reflect off your thumb. If it was dirty, you were on a charge. So every night, before being caught and put on a charge, you'd clean your rifle.
Did you have a rifle that stayed with you? You know, I mean...
Oh, yes. It's your personal weapon. Get to know the number as well as you know your army number.
Were they good and bad rifles, would you say? I mean, or were they just all much of a muchness?
I think much of a muchness, because you could regulate its ability by moving the foresight, a floating foresight. If you fire it to the right, you tap it to the left a bit.
Would you do that, or would the armourer do it?
The armourer. But you don't have an armourer in action.
So that's a rifle. Let's look at the bayonet. That's a, well, stuck on the right. You know, how about bayonet training? How important was it? And how
they put a great emphasis on it. I think the number of times in both World Wars, there were over exaggerated bayonet charges. Many a time we put bayonets on, stick your bayonets on, but you didn't go charging at anybody with them. They were there, they were a fright, if anything, if you were close quarter or house breaking. But the number of times in either war was negligible, the bayonets, this business, sticking your bayonet in, putting your foot on and pulling out. But they played a very big emphasis on it in training. But in my mind, the object of that exercise was to build up determination. Not so much you were putting into practical use.
How did they teach you? I mean, were you charging at sandbags?
At dummy models. In, out, on.
Were they teaching you to still, there was some fuss about it in the First World War, but to shout and scream as you were doing?
Screaming like banshees. And it does build you up. I mean, if you run down quietly and did that, but if you, you let go, you're giving it everything you've got.
Did they spend much time, I mean, there's two sorts of, did they spend much time teaching you to bayonet fight in the sort of classical one bayonet fighter versus another, you know, bring the butt through?
That's what they used to term that as bayonet fencing. And that was done in the gymnasium. You want my opinion? Waste of time. Because I don't know anybody who's bayonet fighting an enemy. Of all the men I've ever met, there's nobody ever. That was done more of a sport, like epi fencing. In the gymnasium.
Did everyone do it though?
Everyone.
But was within there was quite an emphasis on bayonet fighting, but within bayonet fighting, was there much of an emphasis on fencing as opposed to charging at sacks?
Well, bayonet fighting was just charging at sacks. And then when you'd gone through the first sack, the next dummy was on the ground, a soldier lying there. So you rammed it in, put your foot on him, and bodied out, twisted. Well, I don't know anybody who's done that.
Right, so, but that's another side. Now, the next one is the light machine guns.
The LMGs, it was then.
LMG. Now, which ones were they used? Were there Sten in by then, or was it a Thompson?
Sten was a Douglas machine gun. It was so named because it cost 19 and sixpence to make. First class weapon for operation service. A lot of soldiers used to double spring them.
What does that mean?
You've got it's gas and spring operated. So it's an automatic, so it's on a spring. They would put another spring in, same spring, but two in, to make it fire faster, which is fake. Because the faster you fire, the quicker you run out of ammunition. The more you've got to carry. The degree of accuracy goes, because it's so rapid, it takes some holding, you're starting to shake. So it was far better to leave the stem gun as it was with its original spring. There was very few stoppages on it at all, whereas the American submachine carbine, the Thompson, if you got what they call a HP stoppage on that, you were out of action for 5 to 10 minutes.
I'll come back to the Thompson, because I specifically want to ask, how did they train you in the Sten? I mean, did they have a place to practice firing it?
Yes, what they had was wonderful. The perfect way to train a soldier. Transitional shooting, which meant you walked down the track and targets sprung up and you engaged them.
They had that at Bransforth?
They had those going there then. Not as well conducted as they were later, especially in Malaya, where we, and that's another story.
We'll be coming to that, yeah. So targets would come out even at that in 40.
Yes, just pop up. They pulled them on a string.
And how the thing about the Sten is, how accurate was it? Because what was the effective range? Would you say?
Ranges I never bothered with. Effective, sufficiently accurate at the distance you can shoot. Now, what's the use in having a rifle that shoots a mile when you can't see a human body at a mile? 500 to 600 yards was about the maximum with effect, a 9mm shell. Now, at that range, with a Sten gun, the amount it fired, if you let half a mag go, you should hit him. Irrespective of how good you are, firing from the hip. Because if you're firing from the shoulder with them short barrel weapons, is none. Your degree of accuracy is nullified.
So you're better off, you're more accurate from the hip.
Well, from the hip. It's more steady. And you're looking, your eyesight's alive, that if you stop a deal with a Sten with a magazine pointing out there, your vision's in there.
So you would say 500 yards?
500 yards. Why fire is a man if he's more than 500 yards away? If he's moving, you're not going to hit him. Because you're not sitting down taking aim, you're just letting go. So the chances are, 500 yards is a long way in open country to see a man, and he's not exposing himself. As soon as he's fired at it, he's going to hit the deck.
Now, I've heard some people say that you couldn't hit someone at 50 yards with a Sten, but you're saying that perhaps they're meaning one shot, you're meaning with a magazine, you know.
Well, you know, why have a Sten submachine carbine when you're going to fire single shots? The object is to send more. What I would say, jokingly, of course, the man that's going to hit another man at 50 yards was a bag of nerves.
So you, as far as you're concerned, you could use the Sten with some effect, some good effect, at about 400 or 500 yards.
Oh yes, for what you want it. Especially if you want to keep the heads down, which is one of the objects of the exercise. If the heads are down, they're not firing.
So it's in a way quite like your policy with the rifle. What you're trying to do is to cover an area, and you know, to keep heads down. Hit anybody who's wandering about in it.
Well, you're always taught, and it's probably very sensible, immediately, whether it's the jungle, European theatres, wherever, if you're ever fired on, and you don't really realise it instantly where the fire's come from, fire back, anywhere, initially, because he thinks you found him. Because he's fired and taken cover, and he's hearing shots. And you know, I don't know whether you know it or not, Peter. A shot, when it passes you, is crack thump, crack thump. Now, if you don't hear that, you've got a wooden top coat. Because it's past you when you get the thump. You keep him down, and then look and find where he is. And then you can end it. But go to ground and fire back.
Now, would they teach that at Brandsmouth, or is that later you picked them?
I think you learned that by experience.
Now, the Sten, you said the Sten didn't have many stoppages. Did it have stoppages, though? I mean,
purely, it was so easily put together and dismantled that the only thing that stopped the Sten was particles of earth and dust, you know, in action. You're not as meticulous as a cleaning method is when you're tired. You're wet through. It's been lying in a slip for quite a few hours, and one thing or another. Get a particle of dust in there, and it can affect the bolt action moving forward.
How would you clear that sort of jam?
Pull back and blow it out. Put a bit of cloth in it. Wipe it out with your fingers. But the worst jam was a spent cartridge. It fires a 9mm shell, and if it doesn't connect correctly, it doesn't extract it. So it gets jammed in the bolt mechanism. So use anything. Your fork, it needs to be. Just fish it out with the vital seconds. But the stoppages were few and far between at the center.
Now, the Thompson was the other one, the American one.
Now, more complicated.
Now, you trained in that at Brandsmouth, did you, as well? You didn't meet that there.
No.
Right. Well, we'll come back to that later then. But so the Sten was by then the one that most of you were training on.
Yeah. But when you went in action, you reverted back to your rifle, because the majority still carried rifles during the war.
So you'd have both?
We had a mixture of both, yes.
So, what about the Bren? Because that used to be pretty well, everyone used to get trained.
Far too accurate a weapon for the infantryman. Far too accurate. Inflated and deflated fire. If there was 10,000 Chinamen coming towards you, you got done with your Bren, you've got a bipod, it's rested on. So you fire, you would put a sword right through them that wide. Whereas a machine gun like the British would deflate, spread. The Bren was far too accurate. Out on patrol at night, it you don't know how many men's in the opposite camp. So you spot a group, so you fire at them, you may have success, but there might be 50. There's 48 got away with it, 50 were.
So the Bren, one bullet followed another bullet.
Exactly. Well, on the range, you can hit the ball with it, but you don't want that in action. Hence, I say the same with a rifle. You won't. You have to think there's a lot more coming at them from all angles.
So the Bren, I mean, if all things were left, one shot would follow another and hit what the other one had hit. Whereas with something like the Vickers, there was a natural spread as well as anything the operator might do.
Belt of fire. It spread.
Did you train in the Bren much at Brandsburg?
All the time. The emphasis on it. When the Bren was first initiated, it was belt fed. It had a belt in. That didn't work because the cooling system, it was air cooled. Even after the modifications, when you fired two magazines, the barrel was red hot. And they always used to say the first IA on a Bren gun is full back mag off, butt off, and bugger off. You say, that's what they used to say. But to get the barrel off, you had to take your soft hat off if you were wearing one, because the barrel was red hot. And it was air cooled, which wasn't sufficient. That was one of the downfalls of it. You always carried a spare barrel.
But this was in your day still, was it?
Oh, all the way through. They couldn't perfect that at all. You see, the Germans' Spandau machine gun fired twice as fast. And interlaid and delayed spread all over the place, the Spandau. If you were getting stoppages, you had to fiddle about with a gas regulator to give it more gas. It was gas and spring operated. A highly technical weapon, beautiful to look at, beautiful mechanism, but no answer to the German Spandau.
So you were trained in that. Did they do a lot of training in stripping? And
oh, yes. Instead of going out in inclement weather, you'd do many period, blindfold in a barrack room, as if you were operating by night. You have a blindfold off, and you've got your five groups. You've got butt, barrel, bipod, body. And you to reassemble them in the dark. It'll be split down, and you clean your way around and put it all back together again. A very great emphasis on weapon stripping in the dark. Again, maybe it's more. Very few cases you'd strip a break in the dark anywhere. You get down with a trench anywhere and flick a light or just or whatever.
But it would give you the confidence.
Yeah, you know your weapon backwards.
Had the Lewis gone by then?
The Lewis was out.
Now the Vickers, they wouldn't train you in the Vickers at Brandsburg, would they?
The Vickers is a specialist weapon like support company. Mortars, machine gun, anti-tank, and assault.
So you, in the squad, you wouldn't do that. Now, any other machine guns of any sorts? It was just the Bren and the Sten.
Sten and rifle. The other weapon, which was most important, was the Piat, the primary infantry anti-tank. The pros and cons. It had been about 5'6". To cock it, and to cock it, you to be about 10 stone or more. It was a very powerful spring, and you to pull it, you to put your 2 feet on 2 flaps, which used to rest on here, lift it, and turn it by heart, and then let it go back. Now then, the points against it, A, the bomb that you fired, the initial bombs that brought out, were shaped like any bomb you place it in, a forerunner of the rocket launcher. And a little stem at the end, like Concorde. Now, if you find that as a tank, and it went through a visor, it wouldn't go off. It had to have impact on the plant of the barn. So they improved the barn and the shoulders then were ignited. So if the shoulders hit any part, that was a fair one. The second thing is, so Sam made you lose your arm with it. You had a guide ring on it. And when you fired, you had to take aim, squeeze, as if you were boxing, move your head to one left. The guide ring used to come back and catch it here or in the face. And it was like a piece of shrapnel coming back. Again, only used for knocking out tanks. If you remember, the lad in Italy got it with a BC for knocking a tire at time track. The forerunner of the rocket.
Were they just spring powered then?
Spring powered.
So that's all they were, was like a catapult?
Yes. But a vicious spring, that's why. You needed a lot of lads couldn't crack it. And if they had a bit of height to gain the leverage, you couldn't crack it. So you had to pick a man that was physically equipped to fire it. But you only carried a couple to a company.
Were they accurate?
They're quite accurate. All 50, 60 yards.
That was the range.
I would say, I think I'm right in saying it was about 50, 60. But if you're engaging a tank, or what we used to use it for, especially in Greece, was knocking at factory gates, blowing a hole in factory gates, to run into the pull that camera. So.
Now, the next batch of weapons is all grenades, the various sorts of grenades. Now, the basic one would still be the Mills bomb.
Mills 36 grenade.
What did you think of that as a weapon?
For close quarter, a house-breaking roll, I thrown into a room, pause, and then dive in. Dispensation was assisted with fragmentation. It was cooked like a chocolate bar. And of course, when it went, it shared it out amongst everybody who was in there. So they all got a little bit of it. And you 2.5 pounds of cast iron flying round, quite a formidable weapon. But the dangers of carrying them on one's person, if you get hit, it might have just scraped your groin, but if it's a grenade, you've got a lot on top of it. So they weren't keen on carrying them. The other role they used to do, when the wire was up, the double wire, you crawl out at night, take out the safety pin, and hang the grenade on the wire. So if Johnny comes creeping through, he'll knock it off. But the nasty job was going back next morning to pick it up. So one didn't. One fired at them and blew them. But they were a good protection. You felt very safe if you had a grenade on your wire. Because if anybody did make a move...
Where did you learn that? Because I've not heard that one.
It's not taught in the manual. These are things you pick up when you get there.
Right. That's the sort of wrinkle that we're very interested in. So I've not heard of that one. Did they give you any practice in throwing them?
Oh, yeah. Casualties ones are. You had an instructor and a soldier in a throwing bay, which was a trench. And a 7-second fuse was on the extra yielding rifle for its trajectory. When you fired it, it was up in the air a lot longer. So at the time it would burst on impact. Throwing the grenade, it was hands across, pin out, back, and throw. 2, 3, down. 4, up she goes. What invariably happened every day on the throwing range, nervous kids would throw it across trench up in the air and drop in the trench. You were fiddling with the bomb, steaming away and throwing it out. A handy weapon, like everything else, it had its pros and cons. Carrying them was a problem, but if you had them there in a box by you, they were very handy for close quarter combat, as you might say, I'm primarily banging on the wire at night, but specifically housebreaking. And like you see, the SES, they go to a building, they kick the door, they throw a stun grenade in them, and he stuns them all. That more than stunned them. But you felt safe running in after that.
Now, I wanted to ask, because there were other types of grenades.
Yes.
Even then, they had the stun grenade, a plastic one.
The 69 grenade. Now, that was a wonderful grenade, because if it went off, it didn't hurt you. But to get the best value of that, if you're going on patrol and you spot a German patrol, I say German, by virtue of the fact, their patrols were approximately 80 to 100 men. Our patrols, when your battalion was at full strength, was 1 and 10. But you were never at full strength, were you? Because you'd sit lame and lazy. So you were invariably going out with 1 and 5. Now you spot Jerry, it's pitch dark. You're in a hell of a state. You can't take him on the relay. So you toss a 69 amongst him, and it gives such a bang. Lightens a little and they panic. And as good a soldier as they were, they had to have leaders. They weren't like the British Tommy. If you got knocked off, one of the lads would take over. Jerry, he wasn't like that. If he told them to go there, they'd go without faith. But imagine it's dark at night, utter silence by animal noises. And then a horrific bang right amongst you. Put the fear of gravity. Then they panic. Then you'd open up and take off. Go back. You'd have contact. So forth. And you'd do the mission.
I've heard they were used for house clearance as well.
They were.
When they didn't want to kill the occupants.
That's right. They wanted prisoners. Throw them in. But you could be in the room quicker with a plastic grenade than a 36, because you'd give it a full second after explosion to make sure you didn't get any Irish confetti. After the Bakelite, dive straight in, because the only Bakelite was flying around, but it's the bang and the suddenness of it all. They don't know what's hit them. They don't know if they've been hit, wounded, or what.
Now, another grenade I've heard of, and mixed reports of it, is I think it's a phosphorus grenade. Did you see them at all?
A nightmare to carry, I ask you. Common sense prevailed. You're carrying a phosphorus grenade and you get hit with a bit of shrapnel, you go up in a plume of smoke. A vicious bomb. The troops down the airport. Well, you can't refuse to do anything in the service, but I'll tell you what happened to them, like the 2-inch mortar bombs. As soon as you got off the trucks, marching forward, you throw them away.
I'll come back to in training. Did you actually get to throw them and practice, or was it just the 36?
You throw one phosphorus. You throw 5 or 6 36, and you wouldn't throw 69. You take them out at night time, and you were laid on a bank, and then there'd be a patrol coming. They knew what was happening. And then one of the instructors would throw 69 towards them. And so now they imagine that with you and you didn't know it was coming. The bang. To get the effect.
What did a phosphorus grenade do? No, I mean, what was it used for? I'm a bit
Burned to death, literally. Hot, horrific burns. The 3-inch mortar had HE and white phosphorus. That was first class. That was being fired 3,000 yards among an enemy, especially in Korea, where there was thousands of Chinamen. Of course, havoc. In the others, you hardly use white phos. On the other hand, if you wanted to pinpoint a target with a ranging bomb, you might use a white phos, other than just a quick blast. So when it hit the deck and the white phosphorus came out, you get your compass bearings on. So it had a dual purpose, really.
Any other types of bomb other than those three?
Not really.
Now, the mortars, you wouldn't learn there, not two or three.
Specialist weapon, by extension.
So that comes later again. Any other weapon you can think of? I can't think.
Well, not really.